Good morning and happy Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Defiant Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Majid Padellan, a.k.a. Brooklyn Dad Defiant. I don't know who needs to hear this, but if you're placed under a gag order by a judge and told not to attack the court, the judge, his family, the prosecutor's family, and prospective jurors, it's probably a good idea to keep your mouth shut. But no, Donald Trump continues to press his luck with Judge Juan Merchan, who he's all but daring to send him to jail for contempt. Fun fact, not only has Trump violated his gag order, he's done so 7 times. 7 times since the trial started on Monday. And that includes at least one instance in which he seemingly posted while he was in court. On Monday, prosecutors requested that Trump be punished for allegedly violating a gag order barring him from attacking witnesses, prosecutors, court staff, and jurors involved in the case. Judge Merchan scheduled a hearing on the matter next week. On Thursday, the prosecution requested that additional alleged violations of the gag order be reviewed in the hearing. The prosecutors pointed to several public statements and social media posts the former disgraced president has made over the last several days. "It's ridiculous. It has to stop," one prosecutor said. This was followed by a broadside from Trump against the court on his failing Truth Social platform. "My trial is an assault on America," Trump posted. "This conflicted, Trump-hating judge won't let me respond to people that are on TV lying and spewing hate all day long," he continued. "He is running roughshod over my lawyers and legal team. The New York system of justice is being decimated by critics from all over the world. I want to speak, or at least be able to respond. Election interference, rigged, unconstitutional trial, take off the gag order." Trump's attorneys countered that the social media posts in question, quote, "do not establish any willful violations," and claimed that reposts of other people's statements do not constitute violations. But some of Trump's posts have been fairly egregious. According to Politico, state attorneys pointed to the former president's invocation of right-wing conspiracies about the jury selection process as the most disturbing example. In a Wednesday Truth Social post, Trump quoted Fox News host Jesse Waters, who claimed, quote, "they are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury." That's total bullshit, folks. Dozens of prospective jurors have already been disqualified for potential bias, and that includes the woman that Trump sought to intimidate on the second day of jury selection, earning him a stern rebuke from Judge Merchan. Of those who have made the cut is a juror who admitted to watching Fox News and another who commented that Trump, quote, "speaks his mind." Merchan has warned Trump that he'd be held to the same standards as other defendants and could face penalties or imprisonment if he was overly disruptive during the trial or failed to appear in court as required. This has been the running game that Trump has played with this judge, a kind of rope-a-dope where he makes these ridiculous statements and then all but dares the judge to do something about it. Merchan anticipated this behavior when he expanded the scope of the gag order on April 1st, commenting that, quote, "it is no longer just a mere possibility or a reasonable likelihood that there exists a threat to the integrity of the judicial proceedings. The threat is very real. Admonitions are not enough, nor is reliance on self-restraint." While the former president's behavior out of court is already becoming an issue in the trial, his behavior in court isn't helping either. On Thursday, Trump was spotted using his cell phone in the courtroom, a clear violation of Merchan's rules. The former president has also reportedly dozed off or fallen asleep at the defense table on every day of the trial so far. On Tuesday, Merchan reprimanded Trump and his team after he was heard muttering commentary during the questioning of potential jurors. Quote, "I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear. Take a minute with your client," Merchan told Trump's attorneys. In a motion filed Tuesday, prosecutors highlighted a number of posts Trump sent on Truth Social attacking Michael Cohen, a potential star witness in the case. Under the gag order, Trump is barred from making statements about possible witnesses in the case and their, quote, potential participation in the trial. In one of the posts, Trump referred to Cohen and a former prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office as, quote unquote, thugs. The potential of harassment against jurors is already having an effect on the selection process. On Thursday, one juror who had been selected for the trial requested to be excused, citing concerns about the amount of identifying details about her being reported in the press and the potential of being identified publicly. Quote, "Yesterday alone, I had friends, colleagues, and family push things to my phone regarding questioning my identity as a juror," the juror said. Merchan granted the request and implored reporters to use common sense when writing about jurors. Quote, "There was really no need to mention that one of the jurors had an Irish accent," he said, referencing reports on one of the selected jurors. Trump has appealed the gag order, arguing it's an unconstitutional violation of his First Amendment rights, but it remains in effect as of now. And over the first 2 days of jury selection, his lawyers took aim at prospective jurors' social media posts, claiming many showed anti-Trump bias. The judge agreed to dismiss a few of them for cause, but declined to do so for others, finding their posts did not show that they would be unfair to the former disgraced president. None of this should be news to Trump, who so far has been hit with two other gag orders in his prior legal trials. In October, Judge Arthur Engoron silenced the motor mouth after he shoveled a deluge of far-right venom onto Engoron's chief law clerk. Trump was later fined $15,000 for violating the order. Judge Tanya Chutkan also imposed a gag order on Trump in his election interference trial. The theme of each is, "Shut the fuck up in my court or we will jail you or fine you." The penalty being sought is mild considering Trump's wealth. $1,000 for each of three violations of the court's order, an order to, quote, remove the social media posts attacking Cohen and Daniels, and a warning that, quote, future violations of the court's restrictions on his extrajudicial statements can be punished not only with additional fines, but also with a term of incarceration of up to 30 days. In the case of his civil trial, Judge Arthur Engoron's fines had their intended effect. The threats stopped for the balance of that trial. Part of me says, lock his ass up. But here's the truth. Trump wants to be found in contempt of court. Being jailed, while unpleasant, would only serve to fan the flames that he's being persecuted as a political prisoner. If you want to hurt Donald Trump, you have to humiliate him. Forget jail, forget fines. Make Orange Jesus pick up trash. That's right, community service. The idea is anathema to someone like Donald Trump, who has spent much of his life cloistered in luxury. Force him into an orange jumpsuit that matches his complexion and make him pick up garbage. This is a real consequence used by judges in New York City. I don't have any means to actually impose this punishment, but I can push the topic on the platform that used to be known as Twitter. Earlier this week, when Trump dozed off in court, I was able to get hashtag Sleepy Don as a number one trending topic. I say it's time to push hashtag Trashman Trump out there and petition the court to consider sentencing Trump to real trash duty for contempt. Watch this space for more on that. And now for the big talk. My next guest on the Defiant podcast is Harry Lipman, the former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. Lippman is currently the legal affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times and a professor of constitutional law at UCLA and UCSD. Harry can be seen as a legal and political commentator on CBS, NPR, MSNBC, and CNN. Lippman is also the creator and host of the Talking Feds podcast. You'd be smart to subscribe to the Talking Feds YouTube channel. New episodes are posted daily, and he features the greatest legal minds and tough-as-nails former prosecutors breaking down the latest in Trump felony news. You can see him live at Talking San Diego. It's a first-of-its-kind speaker series that brings to San Diego some of the nation's most prominent national figures, like Representative Jamie Raskin, who kicked off the series last month. You'll want to mark your calendars for this next event. On Wednesday, May 15th, Harry will be in conversation with none other than Jen Psaki, former White House press secretary and the author of her newly released book, Say More. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit TalkingSanDiego.net. Lippman joins us today to discuss everything you've ever wanted to know about jury selection on the Trump hush money trial, as well as what's at stake should Trump come out victorious. Let's run the tape. Okay, Harry, thank you so much for joining me on the show here. It is an honor to have you here, Harry.
It's really nice to be here, Majid. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by discussing the historic nature of the Trump hush money trial. For the first time in history, we have a former president being tried for a felony. It's also the only trial that we're likely to see before the election. So discuss with me your expectations for this trial and how you think each side will use it to their ends.
Yeah, you know, of course, it's historic in its very nature, but you're right to put the question that way, because that's a little pivotal, I think, for the prosecution. Well, first, they're going to want to use it to paint a picture, if they can, of election interference, of a plot to derail the 2016 election, a whole kind of scheme beginning earlier on, and then a kind of crisis point that hits when the Access Hollywood tape is published, and the sense within a campaign that his electoral prospects are hanging by a thread, and therefore they have to really act firmly and quickly to smother the news that when it comes forward of Stormy Daniels. So that's, I think, what Bragg will be looking to do. And relatedly, the charges themselves are a little bit arcane and hard to follow the way they are plug into New York law. So he'll be looking to simplify. Trump, I think it's always about a political narrative. And I think that narrative will be either, if he loses or, you know, setting up a loss, one of martyrdom and assault and a political campaign by the deep state, not just against him, but his supporters. He's sort of, you know, in some messianic way, taking it on for them. And that, I think, will be the refrain he'll stick to should he lose. And there, I see no prospect of his winning of an acquittal. But if I do see a prospect, and I think they're hoping, kind of playing for a prospect of a holdout juror that would result technically in a mistrial that, 11-1 is pretty close, but I think that he'll look to play that as a great victory and a judgment against the evil state. So those, I think, are the sort of competing narratives that each side will try to further.
And close, as we know, only counts in hand grenades, horseshoes and hand grenades. So 11-1 isn't going to cut it. Put your thinking cap on. I'm assuming that your thinking cap is always on. But if you could telegraph, what are the hidden landmines for the prosecution and for the defense? What do they not see that could potentially upset either side?
Well, there are definitely mines that they could step on that could upset them. I don't know if they don't see them. It's funny, like a lot of prosecutors, you really want to have a trial. And then when you prepare, you think, why did I do this? A very, very famous trial lawyer, Edward Bennett Williams, said trial lawyers don't get tired of the combat, they get tired of the road work. So I think if they're doing their job, they'll have anticipated it all. But I think that Trump just won't, and his side won't have been able to fully appreciate, or will be backpedaling hard when not Michael Cohen, but a witness like Hope Hicks takes the stand, who is obviously credible, sweet, not anti-Trump, and detail certain conversations. Under the rules, they ought to know what the conversations are, but that's going to be a precarious spot for them to be in. And then likewise, there are going to be some details. Cohen, they think they'll really lambast, and there'll be a bruising cross-examination. It'll be the centerpiece of the trial, but there'll be nuggets. One that comes to my mind is he'll testify that Trump said after they won the election, "Do we have to pay her now?" Which is a very vivid proof, circumstantial proof that this was about deterring and the election, not about hush money to protect the Melania or whatever. So there will be, and then there will be unexpected things. That's just part of any trial where a witness will go a little south. You could see David Pecker, who is the head of the Inquirer and will testify about this catch and kill kind of plan. You could see him, he's not exactly a friendly witness to the DA, and you could see that going, a little bit south and having to rehabilitate. The big centerpiece that I think they're preparing for, but my prediction is will not happen, would be what Trump will say and do, which could be anything. He's not, for example, constrained by, say, truth, were he to testify. But I don't think he'll testify. That would be the ultimate landmine if the prosecution rests and the defense says, "Your Honor, the defense calls Donald Trump to the stand." I don't see it, even though he's telegraphing that he's, ready and willing and wants to. But that would be the whole huge roll of the dice and game changer, and one big mine.
I would love to testify. Many people say.
Hey, I didn't know about that skill of yours. All right.
He always says that he wants to testify. He has no intention of doing so.
That's my view. That's my view. It'd be a disaster. Think of, every lie he's ever told, and what did Washington Post document? 30,000 or whatever. Just choose your best 12, become fair game because they go to his general credibility. Plus, he's completely undisciplined. And I think, I mean, he's a spectacular liar of a sort. We just haven't seen, I don't remember seeing on the political scene. It's his instinct. There's just no say, he goes for that immediately. So he could be tied in knots. He gets away with it again and again, but with a skillful cross-examiner, there would just be, he would be disemboweled in front of the jury. I can't see it. And of course, I don't think they'd hesitate to bring perjury charges in the wake of it. I think it'd be a disastrous witness. Also, he appears, if accounts are to be believed, to be really mortified about the conduct itself. So if he gets up there and Stormy Daniels has testified about the affair of Karen McDougal, and he flat out denies it, as he has in the past, that's the next 2 hours he'll just be beaten lumpy and bumpy,
He's such a prolific liar because most people try not to lie because they're afraid that they'll get caught out there in a lie. But he lies shamelessly in a way that he doesn't care if you catch him out there in a lie. And it's almost like he forgets that he's told these lies.
It really seems true. He doesn't seem to worry, as liars do, about congruence with other stuff. I mean, you know, there's a lot bad to be said about Trump, but just as a sort of psychological profile, they'll be digging into this for a while. He gets up lying and lies all day. Politicians shade the truth, et cetera. But this guy is just a spectacular, pathological, instinctive liar, as if the truth doesn't even sort of figure in.
So you already believe that it's unlikely that his legal team will put him on the stand. What would have to happen for them to decide, you know what, we're going to put him on the stand? What instance would have to happen to make them so desperate to put him on the stand?
I mean, I can't see it. They could have concluded that he's going down, as they have, you know, as they did in other civil trials and the like. But then they'll just hope for appeal, or to maybe engender a mistrial or a conflict with the judge, or ultimately his strategy will remain the same. Even if he's convicted, it's not going to go finish on appeal for a couple years. It'll still be win the election and clean up the train wreck after, which is not so straightforward with a state conviction. It's not like in the federal system. But, I think they go into it. This is a fairly complicated case because of that legal issue I referred to up top. So, you know, they maybe have some prospects, but I think they assume they're going to lose, and thus the sort of delay strategy and the like. So even if it looked like a foregone conclusion, you know, the jurors, everyone were just looking at him and glowering, and, you know, just like you could see them already having voted, I don't think it changes the strategy, because the collateral consequences, not just first, he would lie. Second, he would be humiliated, which is a very big point for him with his supporters. He would look, he would be made fun of and look and, you know, really shown up. So I don't see any circumstance that, you know, the normal argument would be like you have defendants who wouldn't otherwise testify when they've really concluded, you know, they're toast. But I don't think it changes it for him. If he's toast, he's got the martyr script to play again and again, and then the hope to win the election and take care of it then. That's my axiom number one. I've even, you know, I haven't trademarked it, but I've used the term a lot, is Trump will not testify. And I don't see a circumstance that changes that.
In a recent interview, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu has flip-flopped and become a Trump supporter. Now, one of his main arguments for supporting Trump is kind of ambivalence about his guilt in these matters. Sununu argues that the American people have become numb to these charges and the trials before they even occur. And to voters, it's just like reality television. So do you agree with his assessment, or do you see these trials as having a real impact on Trump's future?
Yeah, so I mean, that's not the $64,000, it's the $32,000 question. The polls really say, first of all, when we talk electoral future and prospects, it's really important to remember, I forget this all the time myself, we are talking about such a narrow band of, you know, 5% of voters in six states, and whether they can be clawed away from him or would be. And, you know, the 40% are beyond persuasion, and the Trump haters are largely beyond persuasion. There are issues about, you know, will there be impact for other issues, like, for instance, the war in Gaza? But will they be clawed away? The polls suggest that they will be. They're actually a series of poll findings that where people report if he's convicted, 15% say of Trump supporters would have, you know, real second thoughts. And I think it's not just the finding of him as guilty, but his I think, you know, mystique has so much to do with his kind of being either a winner or someone who can really stick it in the eye of a liberal elite. And if he's a loser, that seems to matter. On the other hand, for how many times has it been that it looked like maybe starting with Access Hollywood? Well, now Trump is finished and he's re-emerged. So I think, 10 times burned, 11 times shy about whether it does what the polls suggest. Would it be that somehow it would all be internalized into the numbness that Sununu describes? I will say this, as a reason to support Trump for a political official of Sununu's stature, that's extraordinarily craven. So he's not saying he hasn't done it. He's not saying that the conduct is, as it surely is, maybe is the most sort of serious constitutional betrayal probably in the country's history. He's saying voters are numb. You would think a responsible public official would think, so I need to really, hammer home and sensitize them to the terrible stakes we have, as opposed to, oh, so maybe now I'll go along because what, they won't punish me? So I think he's to be really roundly condemned for saying it. Is it possibly accurate? Polls suggest otherwise, but at this point, Trump has done a kind of jujitsu on bad event after bad event. I remember myself thinking, even attuned as I was to his sort of Houdini escape acts, on January 6th, all right, at least we're done with Donald Trump. Ha ha ha, joke on me and the country. So, you really need to be there and be in the other side to see it. But I do want to add, it's not just the determination from 12 persons, good and true, that he did these deeds, but the feel of him as a loser that I think could pierce the adoration or support of a slice of people, which is all we're really talking about when it comes to does he win or lose in November.
That loser is like the biggest insult to Donald Trump. Right. It's like it's the worst. And, I try to keep my own tendency to enjoy listening to conspiracy theories. I try to keep that in check, right? But I was really, really disappointed when I saw Chris Sununu's interview. I mean, because prior to this, he was supporting Nikki Haley. Even before that, I had heard him in interviews before. He sounded like, one of those reasonable Republicans, it was just like a kind of like a unicorn now. And you can't help but wonder, how does somebody make a complete 180 like that in tone and in substance, like going from this guy is a threat to democracy to, I'll support him even if he's convicted and...
Right. We're not talking about his position on taxes or immigration, right? We're talking about conduct that, if you credit it, as Sununu did, is not simply disqualifying, but terrifying and really augurs the potential end of the democratic experiment. Sorry to put it so in such alarming terms, but every time you think hard on it, they're justified. So if you're someone who's chosen public policy and the good of people at some and the Republic at some point for you to, I don't see anything different from what he's saying then. Oh, Trump will be the nominee. I'm a Republican. I won't have a future otherwise. And by the way, the handful of people who have bucked him, politicians like Cheney and Kinzinger, and also intellectual figures like Bill Kristol, I think they consider themselves toast now. I think they think if and when the Republican Party returns to reason, they'll still be persona non grata. But they understand the stakes are, historic and existential, and they are. And so Sununu and that kind of stance, especially from a, one who portrays himself or herself as a thoughtful, reasonable Republican, is, I think slightly despicable. I'll take away the slightly. I got to either lose the despicable or the slightly. I'm going to lose the slightly.
Thank you for that.
All right.
Now, Trump is attempting to use these trials to make the case that he's a political prisoner and that this trial is an assault on America. Do you think he'll ultimately succeed in making a martyr of himself, or will these trials just serve to make him that much more radioactive to independents and undecideds come November?
Right. And I guess I got to say, I see those as two questions. I think ultimately he will not succeed. I think the verdict of history will be very strong and negative on Donald Trump. But you're at the on this question of can he sort of prevail for in 6 months from now, or how people will, it's sort of similar to what we were just talking about. My view, and, you know, there are people who I respect a lot for their political savvy that I consider, know better than I, who are genuinely, pessimistic. I'm optimistic, and I do base it on things that, you know, really fine grade analyses about the polls and the six states and the anti-MAGA likelihood that's the real plebiscite that we're that's coming. But I think it might just be I'm somewhat optimistic by nature, and I think he is going down in November. And I put it that way just because, you know, if I had a different mindset, I would feel the other way. So I believe he will not prevail in November, and everything that'll happen between now and then sort of at least points in the direction of people coming to judge him harshly and understand the stakes. But you can see the scenario where he prevails. I think it's, a less than 50-50 shot, maybe considerably less. But I do feel on the first part of your question, and maybe I'm grabbing too much, Majid, onto the word ultimately. But I think at the end of the day, just as we think about the know-nothings in the 1840s, or the Reconstruction period, or the people on the wrong side in the Civil Rights era, I think history will record him as a wicked, vicious, singularly anti-constitutional, anti-patriotic president.
I love it. I mean, I really appreciate your optimism, especially since, going back to what you were just saying, I'm there with you. We were both Charlie Brown, and as Lucy was yanking the football away from us, right. Even going back as far as that Access Hollywood thing.
Right,
or,
right. Oh, well, or, Trump's done now.
Yeah, or him mocking, saying that John McCain wasn't a hero because he was captured, or mocking the disabled reporter.
Serge Kovalevich. I mean, the guy is disgusting, but that's right. I think we have underestimated how much a big, I've been told again and again, hammered home that, there are like college educated people in red states support him. And, there really is there. This is a tale of two countries, I think, red and blue. And if you're in blue, as I am, it can be hard to understand the red, and I try hard not to be condescending about and sort of get next to it and understand the reasons. And there is, I think, more than at least I initially understood, just a kind of resentment at the, smugness, maybe they would see it as, mm-hmm. of the people on the coast, et cetera.
The elites.
But there's more than just a pro-Trump feeling, I think. I think he represents some kind of vengeful, dark, reprisal toward people that that people in red states have resented for a long time. I try to say that objectively. I'm not, but look, the country and Democrats, I think, have made a mistake of being dismissive of Trump supporters. It's important, if nothing else, to try to understand, and not simply the MAGA crazies, of which there are many, and who are beyond debate, one assumes. But in any event, at the end of the day, history will not be on Trump's side. I feel that strongly.
From your lips to God's ears. Yeah. Judge Merchan has already, is it Merchan or Merchan?
It's funny. There's a big debate on this. If I can get nerdy for a second, because people in the courtroom call him Mershon, and he accepts that. But my understanding of the proper pronunciation, since he's Hispanic, is Merchan. And that's what I say, even though it's a little bit pretentious, but definitely both fly.
I'm going with that, Judge.
And a lot of people say Mershon, but I'm going with Merchan. Okay.
Thank you. Judge Merchan.
Yeah.
He's already admonished Trump by threatening, if you disrupt these proceedings, you can be excluded from the courtroom and committed to jail based on your conduct, and the trial will continue in your absence. Do you understand? Now, do you expect Trump to turn the trial into a circus by pushing the judge to jail him on contempt and then create other disturbances to undermine the case?
Well, I have an op-ed in the LA Times today that is pretty much saying that. I think on the one hand, he only has he's a one-trick pony. And as rulings come, for instance, in jury selection, he resents. He may try to be disciplined in front of the jury, but his general, instinct, almost reflex of really, playing as a very aggrieved and more than aggrieved kind of, victimized politically figure, I think won't go away. And then there is a strategy for him that doesn't apply to other litigants where, we actually saw it with Engoron, where he said, make my day. If he gets really act up, the real consequence, if he does it in front of the jury, could be a mistrial. That's not necessarily a bad thing for Trump because of the delay. Even though, as I also say in this piece, it makes the strategy that he did on pretrial being so antagonistic, go take it from dubious to asinine once a jury is in place. Nevertheless, my best guess is, we're going to see it. Merchan will be defied, and Merchan's hard-nosed, and I think he's going to get to a point at least where he'll say, he already, with the very statement that you read, kind of fast-forwarded to how many plays does he have if you're the judge? 3, 4? But it ceases to be credible from where he's already sort of put it if he goes too many before saying, next time, Mr. Trump. And at that point, and even generally, it's in Trump's hands. And if Trump wants to dare him to put him in jail, nobody wants to put him in jail for a whole welter of reasons. But he can force Merchant's hand. There's a sort of, you think, he goes to Rikers. Now, there's a holding cell that in every courthouse. And so you can sort of put him in the back and let him think it over, like when you're sobering somebody up, in Andy of Mayberry or whatever. One day, house 2 days for you, and see if that makes him, sober up. So my best guess is he will, in fact, engender that kind of headbutting dispute. And Merchan is the kind of guy who will respond, but he'll try, Will Merchan, to subdivide it into as many stages till he gets to that second to last. But he says the second to last. Trump acts like a jagoff again. That's a Pittsburgh term.
I know it. I was.
You remember? He's a real jagoff. He'll put him in. I think he'll put him in.
Now, if he does that, does that not help Trump?
So, great question, right? Because Trump is playing two tables, the political and the legal. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit related to the questions we had sort of in the middle of our discussion here. But certainly you see an aspect. I want to take a step back and say some of the other cases seem so strong against him, but I can imagine people in the red part of the country, New York, hush money porn star, a judge who I think it's pretty clear is not well disposed toward Trump. So, you can imagine if he puts the former president of the United States in the pokey, God knows what his hair looks like when he comes out, people getting sort of inflamed. And I think he doesn't want to do it. There's no doubt Trump has done things that would have landed any defendant, white collar business, titan to street drug dealer in jail.
Yeah.
And they've you know, tried not to, and not just for him, but for their view of, you know, what would happen in the country. So does it? Maybe. On the other hand, he first and foremost, this is Merchan's, got to control the courtroom and has to look out. This whole gag order thing has now changed a lot, it seems to me. To date, we've been worried about witnesses being afraid, coming forward, et cetera. Right. We've got a jury in the box now, or we will shortly. And if he says, you know, crazy crap about the case that would really pollute the jury pool, Mayor Chun's got to come down on him like a ton of bricks. And, you know, that's so I see the conflict really happening. If he forces Mayor Chun's hand, will it in some way work to his political advantage? Maybe.
You know, for all of Trump's caterwauling about there being a two-tiered justice system, it seems like he's gotten the benefit of like that top tier, that upper tier. Because as you said, anybody else would have been, you know, would have been screwed by now. And he just keeps getting chance after chance after chance.
Yeah, nobody wants to look like the judge. And also one of his strategies, and another defendant wouldn't play this hand, is to try to make it look like there's personal animosity between him and a judge. Merchan's been very cool. When he expanded the gag order, he could have said, how dare you say that about my daughter?
Right.
But he made it sort of general. But yeah, that's one of his plays. And I think it's right. And it's also, I think, predictable. You know, God, who, you know, you do not want to. He's such a pain in the ass. But you don't want to be there for a lot of reasons, including the American people. You know, you don't want to have the huge distraction of putting him in jail. So yes, he again and again has gotten breaks that others wouldn't get. So to suggest conversely that he's, you know, drawn charges because he's the president, it just doesn't fly. If you look at any of the federal system and the conduct he's done, for sure, which I know pretty well, and I know less well Fulton County in New York. But man, people who did anything close to what he did, well, certainly on the Mar-a-Lago case, you know, the January 6th case is sui generis, thank God. But, you know, the notion that it's somehow politicized, I think, is really spurious.
Yeah. Now, it appears that Trump took a nap in court yesterday and today, today as well. And some are arguing that Trump's legal team possibly sedated him. Do you place any credence in the thought that Trump might have been given a Valium or a Xanax to keep him under control?
I mean, I'll first say it's ironic, given that everyone on his side is trashing Biden for, you know, lack of. I think Biden would manage to stay awake during if he were a defendant in a trial.
Sleepy Joe.
I say this objectively. The guy is not healthy. He's not healthy psychologically. He's not healthy physically. I assume his pill box is big and deep. And whether some of the things he takes, you know, to control anxiety or whatever he controls could make him doze off in court seems very plausible to me. I don't think that, you know, one guy holds him and the other gives the injection before going into court. The evidence, in fact, has been to the contrary. To his disservice, his lawyers have tended to kowtow and play it the way he wants, including here where they, you know, came out with conspiracy theories about how the DA has behaved that Merchan was offended by because there was no evidence behind. But anyway, yeah, it strikes me as very possible that in his, pharmacological box, he's got things that make him sleepy. You know, the guy is a mess. I just flashed on all the lies that he has officially told us. But that, remember when he had his lawyer actually step forward and pronounce, as if he's a historical expert, he's the most healthy president in the history of the Republic. You know, Millard Fillmore might have been close, or Jefferson, but he's the most, he's lost some weight, I think, but he's obese. He eats like crap. And I can only imagine what he takes and what impact it might have. So it wouldn't surprise me.
He's not 6'3" and 215 pounds, that's for sure.
Right. Right.
Now, you wrote that Trump is used to coming and going as he pleases and kind of controlling the action. And now it's the exact opposite. And for many long weeks on end, he's got to sit there and behave and follow someone else's rules. This is going to drive him bonkers. Discuss with me what you foresee happening.
Yeah, I mean, I really think this is an aspect that people haven't quite cottoned on to. But as a prosecutor, you know, I've prosecuted some pretty eminent people, not former presidents, but the loss of control for powerful people is really chafing and infuriating. You know, yesterday he said, and I think he thought, yeah, of course I'll let him go. They asked special permission of Judge Merchan to attend the immunity argument in the Supreme Court next week. Merchan said, nope, I can see that you'd like to, but you know, that's important, but this is more important. And he's taken under advisement whether he'll let him attend Bear and his son's graduation. That kind of thing for a guy like Trump, who in addition strikes me, I really try to avoid being a amateur psychologist with him, but he's got what my tribe in Yiddish would call spilkus. You know, he's just he doesn't sit still very well. and being really under order to, I mean, I've just as a lawyer, you know, sitting at the table all day and watching other things happen and the process involved in a criminal trial takes time. I think it's going to really be chafing day after day after day. And, you know, he's going to, I think it's going to tend to make him blow his top. Now, maybe he blows his top completely out of the presence of the court or maybe in the presence, but that loss of control is something that, you know, if you haven't thought about it or experienced it, it's a big change for, you know, the president of the United States. Nobody tells the president of the United States to sit down, and nobody in Mar-a-Lago tells Donald Trump to sit down. Mm-hmm. He's got that same kind of complete autonomy, and now he has close to none. I think that's a psychological continuing body blow for him over the course of this trial.
I'll tell you, my listeners are going to be really sorry to hear how much he's suffering. behind that. Now, you said recently that jury selection is a highly choreographed process, with each side having a very different goal. Bragg to get reasonable, well-educated, collegial types, and Trump looking for that one maverick holdout. Discuss with me where you think they'll land in 2 weeks or so when the jury is selected.
Right. By the way, this is super interesting in an aspect of trial practice people don't appreciate necessarily. There's been a whole, you get you a name and address, let's say that's what you get of a person. You get a phalanx of like the equivalent of private detectives fanning out to the actual blocks. What's it like? Is it clean? Is there a barbershop? Are there signs for the school board or you know, Black Lives Matter or both? Or, I mean, there really is very fine-grained analysis. And so they'll have a whole binder of you know, that they've squeezed of information. But within a couple weeks, just because of the rules of the game, you have so many cards to play where you can say, I don't like that guy. I just don't like the cut of his jib or whatever they would say. And if it's not a camouflage for race, if it's just, you know, I don't like the way they scratch their nose or kind of that's a legit reason. Otherwise, you have to come up with a good argument. And the time is going to come for both. It's just going to be that there'll be, we'll see 12 people and some of them will be ciphers to both sides. Some of them will be people that in a perfect world, or if they had 15 golden tickets and not 10, they'd have bounced. But it's just going to reach a point where, as you said up front, because Trump wants the holdout and the DOJ, I mean, excuse me, the DA needs unanimity, you know, it's going to be, boy, I think number three is really kind of seems to be nodding when Trump nods, or I think, you know, there's going to be some real interesting kinds of mysteries there, and both sides will have wound up rolling the dice some. But a concrete example, today one of the jurors was, have you ever been on a jury before? Yes. What did the jury do? I don't remember. Okay. That's a Trump juror more than it, right? That's like someone who, you know, maybe won't care about the evidence or won't care what other people say. That's the kind of guy that's a likely holdout. Whereas the educated professional used to conferences and committees and, you know, if you believe in your case, as the prosecutors will hear, they want people who will collaborate, talk, you know, et cetera, that way. So they want really different people. And now they go back to the binders they've assembled. And it looks like whatever. There's a lot of trial lawyers who think this is the most important part of a whole trial is jury selection. So this is going to be pretty rich stuff. And Merchan is letting people, you know, because they have a very, very big pool, like 500 or more. You know, normally when someone says, who here couldn't serve fairly? And you raise your hand and you're just trying to get out. And then there's a questioning, but couldn't you put that aside? Merchan says, you can just go. Like half the people I think yesterday was like, you know, we're not going to try to push and fight. Let's take the second group of people who already, you know, are at least willing to talk about it. So, you know, it's been easy to get off this jury so far, which is not the normal kind of course of affairs.
I don't know if you saw the look of astonishment on my face when you mentioned the private detectives, because I recently watched a movie.
We call them jury consultants, but that's who they are. Yeah.
I recently watched a movie that was fascinating. It was called, and it's an old movie, it's called Runaway Jury. You probably, mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
No, but the title is familiar to me.
Oh, my God. So later on today or whenever you get a chance, you must watch this movie. It's starring Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman, okay. John Cusack, mm-hmm. Rachel Weisz. And basically, in this movie, they present the jury selection process as this really slick, high-tech endeavor in which, so Gene Hackman's character, he's the jury rigger, so to speak. He's the guy who sets up video cameras, and he's got actors who go and engage with the prospective juror in a bar to ask him questions and stuff.
Got it.
And I do have a clip from that movie. Do you mind? Can I play it for you?
No. That's great. Let's see it.
All right.
You have any additional plans for this pittance?
Matter of fact, I do.
Lonnie Shaver, manager here?
All day.
Ernie Strode.
I'm going to put you gentlemen in the grocery business.
Grocery business?
We're in the process of acquiring your store.
Meeting with all the store managers to discuss their future roles in the organization.
Poor bastard hadn't had a promotion in 5 years.
Not all employees are going to make the transition.
We've identified you as one of our candidates for the Superhouse program.
How soon can we fly you up?
Mr. Shaver, in subtle and unspoken ways, we made to appreciate the terms of advancement in the Hammond Foods empire.
I don't like the looks of this one.
Ex-Marine drill instructor. These people are looking for a leader. They'll follow Frank Herrera.
If they elect someone else, Foreman.
Whoever they vote for will be following me. Just like in Cincinnati and Oakland and Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, trials are too important to be left up to juries.
So the chilling, obviously the chilling.
Isn't Hackman great? God. What a national treasure. Yeah.
The most chilling quote from that clip is, trials are too important to be left up to juries. And so how...
Just so you know, by the way, Trump would do that in a heartbeat, but that would be going too far. You can squeeze a lot of information just by patrolling the block, and they will.
So the stuff presented in that movie, does that actually happen?
No, but Hackman's role, this guy looks like they'll just, you know, all kinds of internet research. You won't try to actually have any kind of communication with them, but you'll learn a lot. And you might, if that store is next door, maybe it's pushing it a little to like ask the guy, what does this guy ever come in and what's he buy? But I think you can't, you know, personally influenced, but you can really, this is what, and they are high priced jury consultants do. They really, you know, assemble, they start with a name and an address, and they really assemble a pile of information. That's why, you know, it's seen for a time that maybe Merchan was saying, I got another way to try to handicap you if you act up in court. I won't give you the names of the jurors. Now, it wasn't clear if he was talking about not giving it to the lawyers, and he probably wasn't, but that would have been a very big handicap. You don't have a constitutional right, it's statutory right, but I mean, that the difference there. You know, I guarantee you with every, I think they don't have the names of all 500. It's 100 a time. But if they, whenever, as soon as they get them, they've got small armies kind of, you know, getting all the info they can.
Now, I've
and you know, we want to think of the jury system as being fair in the sense that it's fungible. You could take this or the other, but people don't believe that way. You know, you really do think a certain kind of person is who I'm looking for. And again, as long as it's not race driven, you know, it would be the exact sort of judgment you wouldn't want to say in polite company. You know, what I want is a, you know, 80-year-old woman who likes soap opera, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, you stereotype. That's what you do. You stereotype. But also, as I was saying earlier, stereotypes are right often, but not invariably. So when number three or number six starts acting like different, and now you can't, you know, you're just having to watch them every time. Like, lawyers are exquisitely attentive. It's a skill of a trial lawyer without looking at them to see number one nodded there when Hope Hicks said blah blah blah. Did you see that? And you know, that's what they talk about over lunch.
Now, there's another very interesting jury scenario that I just recently saw in one of my all-time favorite comedies, Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's the final episode. Yeah.
Final? No, it's not. What do you?
Yeah,
it's still going on.
No.
No, it's done.
It's done. It's finished.
Nobody told me. Oh my Lord, my son will be heartbroken. But anyway, go ahead.
It is a jury selection scene, and actually, I do have a clip of that too. If you don't mind my playing that for
let's
you,
let's see it.
Circumstances today call for this question. Who here could see themselves stealing a loaf of bread in order to feed a hungry stranger? Yeah? I ask they're all dismissed for cause.
Dismissed.
Damn it. I wanted some of those jurors.
Yeah, no, she was good.
Defense, you're up.
Thank you, Judge.
Oh, wait, I have some thoughts.
What?
All right.
That guy's got a string tie. Let's get rid of him. No liberal would be caught dead in a string tie.
Juror number 20, thank you.
Dismissed.
Not 1122.
Big hair. Shades of Kellyanne Conway. No good.
Juror 22, dismissed.
40. That's a fox watcher.
Dismissed.
23.
You see that comb over? He's a self-loathing bald man.
He hates himself and he hates other bald men. He's got to go.
Okay.
Juror 23, dismissed.
So yeah,
it's perfect, and it sometimes can be intuitions. But here's the thing: you run out that scene doesn't display. You get to juror 23, and that's your last, for you know, no reason challenge. And now here comes a new panel, and you know, someone is you really wish you had. So each side is going to wind up having to accept, a juror or two or three or four that they kind of wish they had. And that's where the whole dynamic of Trump needs one and the DA needs 12 really comes to bear.
Now, can the defendant have input into who is kept and who is dismissed? Or is that just
100%?
Yeah.
I mean, it's his defense. They actually ruled yesterday that he's even going to be present every time they go up to talk about stuff to the judge. And I think, you know, Secret Service follows. But yeah, his fate's on the line. If he says, I think if he orders the exercise of a peremptory challenge for that guy with the string tie, I mean, this is more, you know, like a law school thing than a real thing, but you do it or resign, I guess. Yeah, of course, he definitely has input, and Trump will have input, right? You got to imagine that Trump thinks he has unerring instincts about, you know, people, right? So
yeah, now, but if I'm his attorney and I know that Trump doesn't have the best people and doesn't have the best judgment, is it not malpractice then to take his input as, you know, your guiding principle for who you keep and who you dismiss?
That's really interesting, because what they'll argue on appeal is, yeah, he screwed up. He listened to me. I'll just say there are, you know, going to be 500 little instances of this kind, and Donald Trump is the worst client in the world, bar none. So this will happen again and again, this exact situation. But, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, I insist on testifying, that he won't do that. But you then maybe as a lawyer, you say, I will throw my body over, you know, onto a train before you do that. But who's on the jury? You know, that's so kind of core for, you know, that sort of intuition judgment. I think you gotta sort of respect where a defendant feels like in that situation. You can try to argue about it, and here's the social science that shows of women who of this age really hate you or whatever. But you know, I think that at the end of the day would be his call. And again, you know, it's like in a draft or something. You can play those early on. But we got a lot of jury selection to do and a set number of what they call peremptory challenges for no reason, any reason, as long as it's not race. And, you know, they get very, very dear as the time goes on.
Interesting. I was today years old when I first heard the phrase stealth juror. And I am now scared to death. Just for the sake of our audience,
I need to put it right. I mean, we've seen. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but right, there's like a juror that you would choose because you might think they wouldn't listen to others, but then there's a real risk of what technically shouldn't happen: juror nullification, where somebody has gone on and has already decided, I'm not going to listen. I'm just for Trump, nothing you can say. And, you know, the phenomenon that is Donald Trump in this country, nearly a million people in Manhattan voted for him. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a terrifying prospect here, that there'll be a hung jury, not based on the facts, not based on the evidence, but based on a sort of obstinacy that's apart from all of that.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, everybody knows who Donald Trump is. And if you are trying to get up there and say, I have no opinion about Donald Trump, you're lying. You're absolutely lying. I've known who he was since well before he got into politics, you know. In fact, long time ago when I was like 22, I bought his book, The Art of the Deal, because I genuinely was interested in learning about sales and selling and stuff like that. And I thought, this guy, well, he's a billionaire, so, you know, he must know.
For starters, he didn't even write it, but that's right, yeah.
Right, so, like, when I was called for jury duty twice, and I had no interest in serving on the jury. So I specifically, deliberately told them, I cannot keep an open mind. I'm going to be 100% biased against your client, this hospital, and the malpractice or whatever. So just so they would dismiss me. But it's a terrifying thought to think that somebody could conceal their true feelings, you know, and they could be a Trump supporter and say, yeah, I absolutely have an open mind.
History here.
Yeah.
I'm the opposite from you. I've wanted to be an imperial every time I've served, but I've always been bounced.
You?
I'd really like to be back there. And what's it actually like in these big trials that I told you about, where you pay all this money, hundreds of thousands of dollars for jury consultants? You also will often have full on mock trials. And then you've hired out, you know, for $50 a jury, and you watch them in, you know, through a one-way mirror. That's the closest I've come, you know, do juries do they really try to apply the law? You know, I would, you know, they go into a room, you bite your nails, they come out, they tell you what they've decided. I'd like to be in that room sometime. I don't see it happening to me though. So
is there absolutely no,
someone or another thinks this is not the guy I want. So.
Is there absolutely no way to protect your case against a stealth juror?
Well, there is. That's what this process and peremptory challenges are about. You feel like, and I think a lot of like surgeons, maybe big trial lawyers are cocky and they think they can smell these people, but they get it wrong sometimes. So there, let me put it this way. It is not legal, technically. It's a violation of a juror's oath to be a person who just won't listen, doesn't, you know, go on the facts and law and just votes against, but there's no remedy for it. So in that sense, if someone is super stealth and really good at it, that's right. There's nothing that can be done. But, you know, trial lawyers think they can sort of get a whiff of it. You know, you certainly do sometimes get that feeling. And among other things in these sophisticated trial practices, people will then go interview people who didn't get chosen and see if you got it right. And jury consultants will try to, you know, winnow out their down their whole kinds of intuitions, but there's no surefire way. And if you, you know, you can report to the judge that number three is not deliberating. And he's just said in the room, forget about it. You guys keep talking. I'm going to vote for Trump no matter what. They, you know, that means a mistrial. So there's no silver bullet for it. It's all with those 10 cards, magic, you know, cards up front saying, this guy, he's got MAGA written all over him. And in addition, I don't believe him when he says, I can still be fair. The judge just said, he said he could still be fair. I'm not going to challenge him for cause, as happened in the Curb Your Enthusiasm. So now you got to play a card. And of course, if you're out of cards.
You said there's no remedy for that right, scenario. Okay. So let's say the case goes on and it turns out that one of these 12 jurors is a holdout for Trump, and the whole time that they only find out during the deliberation process. Do you mean to say that there is no, like, if they hold out just because I'm making a statement for Trump and I'm not going to, you know, prosecute him, will that juror, there's no consequences, legal consequences for that?
The short answer is that's correct. A judge technically has the authority to dismiss a juror who is not deliberating. You know, they literally put their headphones on and go, blah, 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 all, you know, that in the middle. But basically, if they just sit there and fold their hands and say, nope, 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 it's a mistrial and you got to start all over. It's not an acquittal. But it's a you know, one holdout who doesn't reason, doesn't follow his or her oath of listening and responding, and, you know, a really bad juror can in fact torpedo a trial.
That's some scary stuff. But I'm gonna tap into your optimism and hope for the best. Expect the worst, but hope for the best.
There you go. Very good. I do, you know, the other case I think are strong, including Mar-a-Lago, if it goes. This one's a little complicated because of this legal wrinkle, but I expect a conviction here.
I love it. Music to my ears. Harry, I want to talk to you about your speaker series. You're doing a series of live events. Talk to my listeners about that.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, we've just started San Diego. Pretty big city. When I was growing up in Pittsburgh, we had something like this, but they don't. So in part, trying to capitalize on, you know, the people that I speak to week in, week out, but usually from afar, We're having a series of about 8 people a year, very prominent national folks, with Jamie Raskin we started with, and it's a one-on-one conversation in, you know, San Diego before a live audience. Jen Psaki is coming up next in a few weeks, and of course, she has a new book, so we're really excited about it. If I could, maybe I'll ask you if you could just, you know, maybe it's possible to put up a thing where if anyone's interested in learning about it or even buying a ticket for Psaki, they can. But we have some really good people coming in the fall. It's obviously a very important year because of the election.
Sure.
And there'll be an overall theme of sort of constitutionalism and rule of law. People on all sides. In general, I mean, there won't be people against constitutionalism, but yeah, we hope this will be a sort of, going forward kind of real mainstay in San Diego with different interesting people, maybe scientist or poet or artist in the future. But here we have political figures, really well-known political figures like Jamie Raskin, like Jen Psaki. And I do the moderating of it. I play your role kind of in their conversations. And they're both a little bit about their lives, but also about public policy. So we hope it'll really sort of spark, you know, an interesting level of public discussion in San Diego, too. So I appreciate you're giving me the chance to tell folks about it.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. Where can people get tickets to these events?
Well, in general and all the time, just go to talkingsandiego.net, talkingsandiego.net, and you can just push a button and get it automatically. You'll also find all the information that's out there. I think we've just put up a little sort of 5-minute excerpt from Jamie Raskin, so you can get a flavor of it. And you'll have all the information there. So there are different places, but the main... The one shop stop shopping would be talkingsandiego.net.
Talkingsandiego.net. And is this event in the same venue every time, or are you moving around to different places?
Yeah, no, we
in
move
San Diego?
depending on who it is. There are some, I won't give their names, but if we do it, we're going to have to rent this big movie theater downtown that seats 1,500. And there are others that, you know, several hundred. And as I say, in the future, maybe people who aren't even so well, you know, doesn't all have to be superstars. This year, we're trying to make it so. But there, you know, sometimes like Jamie Raskin was in the middle of the day, so we did it downtown. Jen Psaki is in the evening, so it's more in the neighborhood, that kind of thing. So we're doing different venues around town. San Diego is a place of many different beautiful settings. This one, like, is on the water. So it'll depend on the guest.
It sounds awesome. I've been to San Diego once. I think I was in La Jolla visiting a friend of mine, and we walked across the border to Tijuana.
I was in La Jolla once, and I stayed there 10 years. I'm still there. It curbed your enthusiasm, apparently.
What's that?
I outlasted Curb Your Enthusiasm. My stay in La Jolla. So I think I'm there for the. My wife and I and fam went to check it out, and we're sticking.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, that's talk San Diego or talking.
TalkingSanDiego.net. Talking books. You get TalkingSanDiego.net.
Awesome. Harry, I want to thank you again for joining us for the Defiant podcast.
This is an exciting new star in the sky. So congratulations for launching it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have today for the Defiant podcast. Stay tuned Monday for my conversation with Grant Stern, the executive editor of Occupy Democrats. Beyond that, if you have the time, make sure you check out that movie I was discussing with Harry Lipman, Runaway Jury. It's an old one, but it's a good one, and it's chock full of celebrities, including Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman, John Cusack, and Rachel Weisz. And it is very relevant. It has everything to do with exactly what we talked about today and what's been going on this week with jury selection. And if you haven't heard of Civil War yet, it's a pretty big movie. It was last weekend's number one movie at the box office, raking an astounding $25 million. It's an almost unheard of number for an indie film of that size. The movie depicts a conflict-ridden United States in which rebel forces battle to overthrow the government. In our current political environment, this movie is an all-too-real reflection of where we are as a society, and terrifying considering that a man with 91 felony charges is trying to sneak back into the White House. And last Tuesday, the Supreme Court began oral arguments around the January 6th insurrection and whether the rioters themselves and Trump himself could be charged with obstruction, a topic that could free many of the worst offenders and let Trump off the hook as well. I know that many of you don't want to consider the reality that civil war presupposes, but with Trump agitating for a second term, we're already much closer than you think. Thanks for listening.